Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. It's great to have you on board, and hopefully you'll stick with us now for the next hour. Right, okay, we're joined on the programme by John Tuffy, who's Head of Programme Healthcare Services with HICWA. Good morning to you, John. Thank you very much for joining us.
Morning, Greg.
Right, okay. Today, details were published of inspection reports on monitoring in public acute hospitals, published today by your organisation, the Health Information and Quality Authority. So talk to us about the inspections at Letterkenny University Hospital and when they took place, and then maybe we'll move on to the findings.
Sure. Today we've published three inspection reports on our monitoring program in acute hospitals, and we carried out between November and December 2022 inspections at Letterkenny University Hospital, Naas General Hospital, and Midland Regional Hospital, Mullingar.
And what were the findings as it relates to Letterkenny University Hospital?
So specifically in relation to Letterkenny, we conducted the inspection on the 16th and 17th of November, and we found the hospital to be substantially compliant in three national standards, partially compliant with six, and non-compliant in four standards that we assessed over the 2 days of inspection. So on inspection, we visited the emergency department, and we visited ward areas within the service. What we found overall was the hospital was meeting some of its performance parameters, so the key metrics in determining how patients are moving through the service. There was meeting some of the HC parameters and was calm and controlled on the first day of inspection. On the second day, attendance were increased, and there was overcrowding in the emergency department on the second day of inspection. Furthermore, we found that immediate improvements were needed in relation to clinical governance and oversight of certain cohorts of patients attending the emergency department, specifically in the respiratory receiving unit within the emergency department.
And could you tell us what that means in layman's terms, John, if you don't mind?
So as we assess, as part of our inspection, we look at the processes that are in place for meeting patients on the door, how quickly they're assessed, and how quickly they move through the service. We also speak with patients on the day of inspection, and we get a view from them as to the care they're experiencing on the day. So I suppose in summary, we found certainly on the first day that patients were being seen reasonably quickly compared to other services. We saw that patients were again being received reasonably quickly through the medical element, but there were 50 patients in the emergency department on the day. And of that, 14 patients were waiting for beds. And on the second day of inspection, we saw instances of patients waiting 18 hours for a bed.
Mm. Now, this obviously is completely unacceptable and is reflected somewhat around the country. Obviously, we know the hospital is struggling in terms of people, high levels of attendance, great difficulties in discharging because there aren't necessarily beds available in the community to treat people who no longer need acute hospital setting treatment. Is that factored in, or do HICWA say, look, we identify the problems, it's up to you guys to fix them?
I suppose it's both, really. Our inspections do look at the immediate measures that are in place in the hospital. So what is the care that people are receiving once they enter a service? We are keen as part of our inspection to understand the elements that affect patient flow within that. And in December 2022, we published a report that essentially outlines the elements that we believe is key factors in the overcrowding that we're seeing in a lot of emergency departments around the country. And some of those elements, as you said, are outside of the direct control of the hospital. They are increased capacity in the community, increased capacity within the hospital, so more beds for them to be able to cater for increased attendances, and also workforce elements as well. That we obviously that services are having increased difficulty in maintaining their workforce and increasing in line with the increased demands of the service.
Yeah, so some things, correct me if I'm wrong, there are things that, with all everything considered, would it be the case that the belief is that the hospital could be doing better with what it has in terms
certainly
of the ED?
Certainly from our inspection, there's operational efficiencies that we outlined within the report that can certainly address some of the key concerns that we've raised, and that's within the gift of the hospital. Mm-hmm. I suppose there is other elements outside, specifically the hospital, that's in the HC control and through the sale to hospital group in ensuring that sufficient resources are within the hospital that there's a key concerted approach to addressing emergency attendance or overcrowding in emergency departments across the service, and not just in Letterkenny University Hospital, it's across the service. So a concerted approach to address that. And we've seen some elements, certainly through the Department of Health, we've seen increased consultant resourcing in the emergency department. So essentially there's a double of resourcing for the consultant. So more of that needs to happen in terms of managing the key elements that we found within the inspection.
I should have asked at the beginning, the initial inspections on the 16th of 17th of November last, are they announced or unannounced?
We do a mixture of announced and unannounced. I suppose from our approach is that we've committed to doing unannounced and unannounced inspections within services over a three-year period, so that we could essentially walk in any day into an emergency department. I suppose the benefit of doing a two-day inspection is that you can see over time how the hospital is actually faring.
So they knew you were coming in November then?
They did know, but that we're coming. I suppose the element of that is that we can receive documents in advance. We can receive information, so we're aware of the performance of the hospital in advance of walking in. Mm-hmm. We also, as I said, have reserved the right to walk in unannounced, which we've done in a lot of emergency departments around the country.
And we'll just move on to some other findings in a moment. But just in relation to the visits on the 16th and 17th of November, as it relates to the ED. Has there been a follow-up since? Has there been a follow-up visit since?
As part of our approach to inspection, we raise any immediate concerns with the hospital itself, with the hospital group, to ensure that they're immediately addressed. As part of our inspection process, we issue a report to the hospital. So we've been validating our findings with the hospital over the last number of months. So as part of the publication today, they have provided a compliance plan which addresses the key elements that we found today. So within that compliance plan is the hospital's commitment to address that. We will continue to monitor that, so we'll receive updates. We'll continue to assess that they are committing to putting the plan into place, and we'll hold them to account for that.
Right. Now, obviously, there was a report published in 2021. It was a HICWA review of the governance arrangements of gynecology services at Letterkenny University Hospital. What did your inspectors find in relation to that, as to how things have changed since that report was published?
A key element of how we inspect is following up on previous inspections, as I've said. We conducted a target review of the gynaecology services within Letterkenny. At the time, we sought that the hospital provide increased assurances in how referrals are managed within the service, that they continue to support the locum consultants, and that performance is reviewed and maintained, and that they maintain an audit program of the service. So as part of this inspection, we took a targeted look at the gynecology service, and we found that the service had been continued to audit, listen to patients, taking feedback from patients on the care they're receiving. We saw elements of performance, and quite good performance in terms of how they're managing the service. So we have seen clear improvements. I suppose from our perspective, those have to be maintained. I suppose an issue that we have seen is their ongoing reliance on locum or temporary consultants to maintain the service. That's likely a feature of many hospitals around the country, is an ongoing reliance on temporary consultants or locum consultants to maintain the service. But we have seen improvements, and they should be sustained in the medium to long term.
You talked about recommendations that needed immediate work, one being comprehensive infection screening programs for patients. What is that talking to?
So essentially, I suppose a key element of patients attending hospitals is that the awareness of if there's any infections that could be transmissible within the service. So we had identified there wasn't a comprehensive screening program for CPE, which is a key organism that must be screened on entry to a hospital. So we raised that with the service, and we requested a commitment that they'd address a comprehensive screening program for patients that are admitted to the hospital.
And what does CPE lead to? Excuse me. What are the risks of that?
I suppose the key, again, something that, that all health services are dealing with is resistant organisms and organisms that are I suppose less amenable to treatment with antibiotics. So the, for us and for most healthcare services, to ensure that they're screening for these, they can address it at source and minimise spread within the service.
Okay, and did they take action immediately as recommended?
So they've continued to audit their own implementation of CPE screening, and they've taken a commitment to address comprehensive screening within the service.
So just to be clear, so we all understand, this is important. Is it to limit hospital-acquired infections?
Yes, this is to limit hospital-acquired infections. So it's across services. This wouldn't. This is something that all hospitals should take into account, is appropriate screening of resistant organism within services. It's something that should be addressed across all services.
And finally, as it relates to how patients are managed on arrival or within the emergency department, have we already touched on that, or were there specific immediate recommendations during these visits in November?
The inspection was carried out at a time when COVID was an important element within the community that needs to be considered. So I suppose that has reduced within recent times and services have adapted their pathways. So it's not necessarily COVID and non-COVID pathways.
Right,
currently.
Well, let's just say, for instance, we had people who contacted programs like this, HICWA, and I understand HICWA can't comment or you can't comment on individual cases, that people that went in with something really quite serious, but they happened to also have a cough, were grouped in with people that were very likely to have COVID. Would that be potentially an example of the mismanagement of patients in the ED?
Not specifically in the emergency department. I suppose we're keen to press the element that patients are screened on admission, that they're appropriately managed where possible in isolation rooms, or national guidance is followed if patients are cohorted together. So again, that's probably across hospital, not specific to Letterkenny University Hospital. I suppose broadly speaking, it's probably an element of all the inspections we've published today. It's essentially a tale of two services. We see the patients entering the emergency department, they're quite overcrowded, but we have seen that there is quite good care given once patients get through the doors and get admitted into service, and that's just keen to impress that point.
Well, actually, I was going to finish on that, and maybe you've already touched on it, or maybe you want to expand on it in the last minute. The positives that came from this, what your team or people discovered, and it was that once people were admitted, the quality of care was high. Is that it?
And that's exactly what we found, that that once patients entered the service or were admitted within to the service, we found that they demonstrated quite good levels of compassion and care on the wards. We saw good initiatives for patients that came within the service. We also noted that the hospital has scored above the national average in all the hospitals for national inpatient experience survey. So again, it's something we're seeing across hospitals, is once patients are admitted, they speak highly of the service, they speak highly of staff, and that's referenced within our report.
Okay, listen, thanks for all your time, John. I appreciate it greatly. John Toffey, who's Head of Programme Healthcare Services with HICWA. As we said at the top of the programme, we are paying the highest rates for electricity in Europe. That's including the UK. We are paying 49.9 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, Germany, which has just shut down all of its nuclear plants, is not far behind us, but we are 50% ahead of, or not far off it, the likes of Belgium, the Netherlands, Sweden, Greece, Latvia. The EU average is just 28.3, by the way. Switzerland, Lithuania. If you're in Hungary, you're paying 9.2 cents. In Romania, 16.3. In Slovenia, 17.4. In Slovakia, 19.7. So far and away. And as I said, sort of at the top of the programme as well, that's having a huge impact on people who have, to some extent, it might have been mitigated with some of the government payments that were received. But can you imagine being in a business and your business in Letterkenny or Boncrana or Donegal Town, your electricity bill is potentially many multiples of that in some countries, but 50% ahead of the EU average. And in some cases, these businesses are having to compete with their EU counterparts. As a coincidence, Tony Forrester, the CEO of Letterkenny Chamber, we've invited Tony on to talk about a business sentiment survey. And you will not be surprised with my big ramble coming into this that the biggest risk factor for businesses in 2023 is those energy costs. Tony Forrester, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
You know, I think it's difficult enough to trade and to stay with your head above water when you're paying high charges. But I think it's even worse when you look across Europe and you see so many others not facing the same bills. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, I think it is. I suppose businesses get on with what they have to live, you know, have to deal with themselves. But it is frustrating that our charges are higher than other parts of Europe that we're part of, you know. But I suppose when we're surveying our businesses, they're saying the energy costs are by far the biggest cost they have at the moment. And it's frustrating for them.
In terms of the business sentiment survey, how deep do you dig in terms of, do we know how many businesses are wondering if they'll make it through 2023? Or do we just talk of the challenges that might hinder their success?
Yeah, we kind of talk about the challenges, Greg. You know, I mean, nobody's going to answer in a survey. I don't think I'll be here in 6 months or anything like that. You know, that isn't really the spirit of it. So we just ask them what the challenges are and what they see as the challenges going forward. And that's really important. We did have a question around, you know, where they see the risks in the next 6 months. And last year, they were kind of talking about recessions and stuff. This year, it's cost and it's increasing costs and how that's going to work out for their businesses in the next year, really.
Yeah, billions of euro remain warehoused, businesses, business tax. Was that a cause for concern or did that crop up at all?
Not really, no. I mean, a lot of the questions we've been asking are about your day-to-day, you know, your turnover. Mm. What the pressures are on your business? Can you employ people? And you know what way are you working now? Is there hybrid working? Is there flexible working? You know, mm-hmm. all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I get you.
And can you get staff? So they're the kind of it doesn't go as deep as that. Partly because there are other agencies to do that, but mm-hmm. also businesses wanted a quick survey that they could do in 10 minutes. And what we'll be doing is mapping these against each other as the year goes on mm-hmm. to see if there's any differences.
In terms of turnover, 78% of businesses believe that their turnover will be equal to what they might expect or even better than expected. There is some encouragement mm-hmm. there.
There is. I mean, I always say, and when I look at these surveys, there's always some people who will come back with, no, I'm
sorry,
looking,
Tony, just
looking
before,
ahead.
I better just clarify because I don't want to mislead. I don't want to drag you into misquote. I misquoted. Sorry, it was 78% in 2022 believe turnover was to be close to expected or better than expected. In 2023, there is actually a slight drop. It's around about just shy of 50% believe turnover will be stable, remain the same, or actually go back the way. So there is some there is some worry out there then so for this year.
Yeah, now I have to say we were quite surprised at the 2022, you know, look back, if you know what I mean, because we weren't sure. Everybody predicted that, you know, it was going to be a very, very tough last quarter. And it actually turned out from our survey that it wasn't as bad as we expected. The domestic market held up pretty well. But yes, going forward, people have definitely pulled back their predictions. Mm. You know, 29% predict stable, maybe remain the same, 24% reduction of less than 25%. You know, so they are concerned. I suppose what we have looked at over the years is that businesses have to be concerned. They have to look at what their pressures are and hopefully that they can work through those pressures. The cost pressures at the moment are very tough. Mm. We all know that because we all have expenses ourselves. So we know that, you know, just paying for our ordinary bills has got much more expensive.
Yeah, in terms of recruiting and retainment, it's kind of a double whammy in that 11.4% of businesses surveyed said the availability of housing is having an impact on their recruitment, but also in terms of maintaining, I suppose, your workforce. 33% of those surveyed hired new staff, 23% have increased opportunity. But labour costs remain a challenge for 40% of respondents. Mm-hmm. Second maybe to the energy costs burden?
Yes, yes. I think what we've discovered, what we see here is it's harder to get people. You know, we're nearly at full employment in Ireland, so it's hard to get people. They're demanding more, obviously, because their costs are going up. So, you know, I'm as an employee, my costs are going up, so I want to demand more when I go into the market. But also the market at the moment is an employee's market. You know, if you can work, as we all know, you can probably work for a larger company and base yourself here at home in Donegal. You know, so the pressures are all there. And then there's been an increase in the minimum, there's been changes in sick pay and legislation as well. So that brings another slight pressure onto businesses. But I think actually retaining staff is really key to people at the moment, and also just getting new people is difficult. You know, there's other opportunities there. Mm-hmm. So we have to make our workplaces much more attractive. You know, we have to make sure everybody gets the right benefits. And I think that's a challenge for businesses as well.
And when you look at the figures, it kind of all goes back to the input costs, particularly in terms of power, energy, because if there was a significant fall in that regard, which would reflect what's happening on the international markets, well, then obviously, you know, the other pressures in terms of paying your staff and even perhaps sentiment, you know, that changes everything to some extent. So the sooner we see a reduction, the actual reductions being passed on to businesses or some other more workable system for the government to employ, because the system currently have the TBESS scheme. Anyone I talk to, they find it far too, they have to hire someone almost to apply for it. And by the time the numbers come in, it's hardly worth it to them. So if we did see either some measures or the international markets actually being reflected in the cost we pay, it would perhaps increase, as I say, positivity, but also make it easier to pay your staff.
I think that's it. If some of your other costs were coming down, or you could see the future of them coming down, yes, that makes all the other costs easier to deal with. And hopefully, you know, staff can be retained. Mm. Much more easily. The housing thing you brought up earlier, 11.4 surveyed said the availability of housing. Now, to a certain extent, that's at the top of the market. You know, the senior executives coming here because there's no housing for people. Mm-hmm. But I think that's getting pressured right down through the market. And I think our next survey will maybe show that as a higher level again.
Yeah.
There just is not enough housing available. And this is one thing I suppose we've been all trying to lobby at a government level, and we do it through Chambers Ireland. You know, housing crisis needs to be dealt with. We have an extra layer of it here, but because of MICA, but on a general terms, all our chambers around the country are talking about housing.
Yeah, Galway released their report. Galway released their report this week, and it was top of the list, I think, almost. Mm-hmm. And I suppose too, businesses and customers are going to have to get used to the fact that there's going to be a certain level of permanent inflation built into this whole crisis. Even if inflation comes back down to the levels that the government are predicting, things are just going to be more expensive going forward.
It looks like it, unfortunately. I haven't really seen costs like this in very many years, you know, but it looks like inflation is going to stay slightly higher. Interest rates are going to be higher than they have been for a very, very long time. It was all deflated for quite a while. I think we are going to have to deal with increased costs over the next few years. I mean, and having said that, we started this conversation, you know, that businesses want to be in business, so they will do everything they can. And what we might be seeing, I think, is some businesses looking, larger ones maybe, looking at how they can make their energy costs lower by, you know, green technologies, by recycling, and I've forgotten what the word term is there. But green energy.
Decarbonisation,
kind of thing.
Is it? Is that?
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Hey,
Tony,
like
I'm
that.
Not clever. It's written in front of me.
I just can't see it.
I can't take the credit for it.
So I that's really far down on people's priorities at the moment. Mm. But I think that's going to change the landscape a little bit for some of the larger companies who can afford to do that. They probably get a consultant in to get solar panels look at their electric vehicles and those kind of things. And hopefully in the long run, that will bring some pressure off businesses. But that's a long-term investment.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting that the majority are more concerned about the risk of a domestic recession, given the massive surplus we have. Almost 50% are concerned about that. In terms of a global recession, it's actually just around about 20-odd percent. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, I would have expected to see those figures the other way round. But really quite interesting. And this is one of many through 2023. So we'll get the trend then as the year cracks on, Tony.
Yes, you will. So we'll be doing another one, I think, around May, June, and then another one towards the end of the year. This is sort of the first, we did a few last year, but this is the first year we're going to really try and map each of these questions and hopes and see what changes are happening over the year. I will just say our businesses have got through so much in the last number of years. It's a word I use a lot, but they are resilient and it's amazing what they get through. I think the domestic recession is just, I don't quite know where that's coming from. Because I don't think Ireland I don't get the sense that Ireland is going to experience that.
I think, and just thinking on my feet here, is the public react very quickly in that you might remember when there was fears that, you know, that we were going to go into recession, people stopped spending very, very quickly.
Yes.
And then when it kind of felt like, well, things might be okay, the public started spending again very, very quickly. And I think it's just really about the sentiment amongst the public that their businesses are feeling. And I get that, but hopefully we're in a steady enough space to try. Because the worst thing that happens in a recession, it happened the last recession, even those with money stopped spending it for fear of, rainy days and what have you. So
that's
maybe
it.
That's
and
where
that's
it's
why,
coming from.
I think that's why we were not shocked exactly in the Christmas domestic markets, that it actually, you know, there was a lot of money out there and there was a lot of money spent. And businesses did much better than they thought they were going to. In the domestic market. So yes, I think there's a lot of we have to be careful of having a conversation that kind of brings us into stopping
the
spending.
Media have a big role to play in that, because unfortunately there seems to be a thing that fear sells, right? It's and whether it's social media or the, you know, old media, whatever we're going to describe it, whomever's trying to make it seems to try and use fear as the catalyst to win people over. And I think that culture needs to change because it has a terrible impact on business and people more generally. We try and avoid it here as much as possible. All right, Tony, lovely to chat to you. Thanks so very much indeed.
Thank you.
Tony Forrester, who's the CEO of Letterkenny Chamber. Our next guest on the programme is author and creator of the new Move Right programme, an associate professor in the School of Inclusive and Special Education at Dublin City University, namely Dr. Sinead McCauley-Lamb. A very good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us. It's good to have you on the show.
Morning, Greg. Thanks so much for having me on.
Right. Okay. So you are trying to change how we teach handwriting in primary schools. Is handwriting not a thing of the past now? I was writing something down yesterday and I went back 2 or 3 minutes later to check my notes, which I couldn't read. It was just a mess on the page. I've got completely out of the habit of writing because I never seem to have to do so. I'm just using a swipe keyboard all the time. So that's me. But do you believe, the ability to handwrite is, and it will have an importance going forward and we should maintain it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great question to start with. It was a question that I was asked several times over the course of when I was completing my doctoral research in this area. I got challenged on that quite a lot. You know, what's the point in doing a PhD in this area? Handwriting is going to pass, it's defunct. But yes, I would say from my own experience and research would say that handwriting is absolutely a really important developmental skill for children to master, particularly in the early years. Number one, handwriting remains the dominant form of graphic communication across schools. So 30 to 60% of the school day at primary level is still taken up with written tasks. And that's despite, you know, a huge and positive move towards kind of active learning, concrete materials, playful learning. But still, in order for children to be able to access the curriculum, handwriting is absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. As well as that, research would say that as a developmental skill, handwriting contributes to early literacy, language skills in the early years as well, so contributes to spelling or language written tasks as well. So it is an important developmental skill as well.
So every now and again, people will talk about algebra, right? And they'll go, I'm 15 million or whatever it is, and I learned algebra and I've never used it once in my life. But really, is the importance not that it helps us learn other things, that we're in how we learn that might assist in just general learning rather than you leaning on it every day for the rest of your life? I'm not sure if that's true or not. You can tell me if it is. But also, handwriting in and of itself, yes, it's an important skill. It's great to have the art of being able to pen a letter or what have you, but it's also what comes from that in terms of other developments. Is it kind of in the same space?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So the research would indicate, because handwriting tasks demand integration of motor visual processing systems, that handwriting fosters early literacy skills. So children showing competency in handwriting in the early years will show more sophisticated letter knowledge, phonological awareness, spelling competence. And there is research to show that children's word writing skills at the end of infants have been used to predict literacy skills. So that includes spelling, reading, comprehension, reading, oral reading. And know that when much of the day is taken up with written tasks, if a child is struggling with that, or the writing is illegible, or they can't access that, then their motivation and self-esteem is going to be hugely, hugely impacted. And that is a huge part, as we know, of school for children. Once you fail in the infant years in school, it unfortunately has that spiral effect where children have bad experiences at school, they opt out. They may appear to be opting out, but really what's happened is they failed somewhere along the way, and it's their motivation and self-esteem is hugely impacted. So until handwriting is not the dominant form of graphic communication in schools, children do need it. Mm. But as well as that, as you mentioned there, it's still a really important functional skill in society as well. So I would be saying, yes, I think there is a place for technology, and, you know, people will challenge that all the time. Well, we have iPads, we have laptops, we can get assistive technology. And there absolutely is a place for that in the classroom. There will be children and there will be older learners that will need assistive technology. But again, the research would say, let's not jump to that straight away.
Well, do we have to be careful here and not allow ourselves to be led by children? In other words, that we might sort of choose the path of least resistance. As you say, you know, I mean, if I were a teacher and I could sort of skip all that handwriting stuff and go straight to a pad, life would be much more difficult. Or a parent sitting at the kitchen table, whereby if you could avoid sort of having to sit over them as they go through their slow handwriting and it's driving you up the wall because it's taking forever to write a word. Mm-hmm. Do you get where I'm just trying to sort of give some... We have to be careful that we, you know, don't put ourselves here and don't choose the path of least resistance to make life a little bit more handy for ourselves, that we have to put the children first and what's best for them.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, in my experience, and as I said, the research would indicate that as a developmental skill, the teaching of handwriting as a skill in conjunction and with balancing assistive technology as well. And we have to remember every learner is completely different. You know, children... No learner is the same. So what works for one child will not work for another child. It has to be based on the child's individual needs as well. And that's, we should always begin with the child's individual needs and go from there. And that the whole, I suppose, idea of the programme, the Move Right programme, really was to look at where children are developmentally. Mm-hmm. That's how it began for me, because the children that were coming into my class, I was teaching for 11 years in a junior boys' school here in Dublin, a DESH school. And the children were coming into school and appeared to me not to be ready developmentally to begin handwriting skills. So in working then and speaking and my experience with lots of occupational therapists throughout my journey in the school, it became apparent to me actually that, well, hang on, this is a developmental skill. So despite the child's age coming into infants, it's where they are individually on that developmental journey. That depends, you know, impacts what I'm going to do with the children. So for me, it wasn't about starting with a pencil and a page or letter formation anymore. I had to go right back looking at the child's gross motor skills. Right. So looking at how the child, their whole body was developed before we could even get to the hand or the handwriting bit.
Yeah, so I've got two books from you here, Move Right Visual Skills Practice Book here, and also the teacher's manual, which I think would be brilliant for parents as well, but I suppose parents are teachers as well. Now, a lot of the stuff is...
Every
page I look at, it makes perfect sense. You know, a half a car is drawn, attempt to draw the other half of the car, pick out star shapes when other shapes exist there, or rectangular shapes. And I suppose in doing so, you're talking about the words and the shape, and there's learning there as well. This is fantastic and a brilliant resource. But is some of this actually absent in schools currently in the early years? Because if it is, it'd be a terrible shame.
So what I tried to do with the programme really was pull together what is already there, but to pull it together in a handwriting programme, because the physical, the gross motor piece, the programme consists of kind of three main domains in terms of motor development. So we've gross motor, fine motor and visual perceptual skills. So typically we look at gross motor skills to do a PE or physical education, and we think about gross motor for sport or for health. But certainly the teachers that were involved in the study also would have said that they didn't look at gross motor development as having a direct impact on children's emergent handwriting skills. Those are separate. So it's not to say that we don't have gross motor development. We do. It's in the PE curriculum. We have a very good PE curriculum. It's there. But it's now pulling it into this kind of context of how do we use it for handwriting? And it's the same with the visual motor skills that you mentioned there. Some of those visual motor skills may be already, we might see them actually in maths books talking about space and shape and patterns, visual sequential memory. But again, do we make that link to how those skills impact on children's ability to copy letters, to form letter shapes? So it was really about bringing those motor components together in a way that was focused on the handwriting piece and enabling children and ourselves to see handwriting not just as a written task, but as this whole body activity that involves the gross motor skills, the eyes looking, visual motor skills and the fine motor skills, which was typically the bit as teachers and parents we're good at. We know what to do with the hands. So we are giving children Play-Doh and jigsaws, and we're giving them lots of nice, you know, Lego, stickle bricks, all that kind of stuff to help build the hands and the muscle. But actually there's steps before that. Mm. We've the visual motor skills before that, and we've the gross motor skills before that.
Yep.
So it's trying to bring those together.
And there's an interesting thing too here that sort of that jumps out at me is about posture when you're writing, or standing at an easel or lying on your tummy and doing writing. And, you know, I look at these images and it makes perfect sense because the head's backward or straight. And yet what we see an awful lot now is the top of our young people's heads looking into a tablet or a handheld games unit or a phone, which is, I think there's been some studies to suggest the impact that's having on their posture, the neck and their back. It's hard to believe that we're having to look at it in a book, because we actually have moved so far away from some of this stuff. Unknowns to us. Between a couple of generations.
It's very foundational stuff. And again, the stuff about the posture came to light for me. I was teaching a first class at the time, and I had a child who was struggling with his handwriting, and an occupational therapist came in to observe him. He was slouched over his table all the time, and I was saying to him, sit up, as we do. And the occupational therapist said, well, he actually can't sit up. He doesn't have the core strength, the postural stability to sit up. So that's not just going to happen by you saying sit up. You have to develop that. And until he has that developed, then he can do his writing lying on his tummy or standing up, which is more appropriate developmentally for him at this stage, rather than sitting in a chair. And again, the research would say that for children with poor postural stability or core strength, the effort and energy that they're expending on actually sitting is being used up, so they can't attend to the written task. So again, he may have appeared to me to be opting out of his written task. Oh, I can't do it, I'm too tired. And you're thinking, oh, you know, he needs to be more motivated and all the rest. But actually he was spending so much energy on just sitting that he was wrecked from that. So you're not just going to catch these skills. They have to be explicitly taught, and we have to put time into developing them.
Listen, parenting, caregiving is difficult. It's tough. It's tough if you're new to it. It's tough if you've done it before and new to it again, because everything has changed. And sometimes we just need our hands held a little bit to know what we're doing is the right thing, constructive. And it's explained to us how doing one thing one way benefits the child. And then that makes us feel good, doesn't it? Because we feel like we're doing the right thing. Is that what you're trying to help parents and teachers with these books?
Absolutely. Yeah, I would, you know, it sometimes when you're doing a piece of research like a PhD, you're in this kind of isolation where you're thinking, what is the point in this? You know, is this going to have any impact? But you know, I'm so delighted to think that, you know, this program has come from that research, and that it will be helpful to parents, to early years educators, to teachers in infant classes, to parents or children maybe who have difficulties that may, you may or may not need a diagnosis. It may be a developmental delay. You may just need a little bit of extra help or a scaffold or a framework around this.
I think this ties nicely too into, I think, an increased understanding and emphasis on the your first year of school is, you know, the day you walk into the early learning and not the day necessarily that you walk into baby infants.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like a lot of these skills, these gross motor visual perception skills, I often think, you know, children would or will develop those naturally through the likes of rough and tumble play, kind of risky play, outdoor play, you know, like proprioception comes from falling around, you know, putting weight through the wrists, play, rough kind of play that sometimes maybe children aren't having an opportunity to engage in that so much. There's lots of, you know, as we know, tape around risky play and, you know, all of this stuff, which is unfortunate.
The second word out of every parent's mouth is careful. Careful.
Yes.
Careful. Yeah,
be careful.
Get away from that. Careful. Get that careful. Yeah, I get you.
And the same as teachers. We want to keep children safe, you know, but it's about, okay, how do we develop these gross motor skills in a safe way? Mm-hmm. And hopefully, you know, there's very little equipment needed. These are body weight, no more than the kind of trend in gyms has gone towards body weight kind of exercise. You can do it with very little.
Yeah.
It's about how we move our bodies and a new awareness of how we move our bodies.
Okay. The Move Right programme's published by Just Rewards Publication in County Donegal, which is a nice local collection here, connection. And you can check out the website. Where do you suggest people go to look at this, and who is the market for it? You know, I mean, obviously it's teachers, is it?
Yeah, so teachers, preschool teachers, parents, ABC School Supplies, and my own website is SineadMcCauleyLamb.com. So there's some information and some just some blog articles around my own experience there as well.
Yeah, common sense. It's lovely to hear it because it's kind of absent an awful lot nowadays and it's easy.
Yeah. It's not rocket science.
It's not,
putting it together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you've done a superb job in doing that for us. Thank you so much. It's been lovely having you on the programme. Take care. Dr. Sinead McCauley-Lamb there, who is the author of the new Move Right programme there. Very interesting little books, I think. And I think they'd make life a little bit easier for parents. Shane O'Donoghue is editor of CompleteCar.ie. Good morning to you, Shane.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to have you back on the show. Right, okay. Gardaí are soon to have perhaps another weapon in their armoury, AI speed cameras, which would be capable of detecting whether or not we're holding our phone on the phone or whether or not we had our seatbelt on. This is the AI, everything's moving so quickly. It's possible, isn't it? I mean, why not?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think the technology is going to be the limitation here. It'll be perhaps the cost and the legality of everything. I think the one thing to tell listeners, of course, is that this is at the very early stages of investigation whether we're going to be using this. So the Gardaí are, before they even put anything out to tender, they're looking at the feasibility of the technology to make sure this is something that could be used, is something that would be effective, and of course whether the legislation would cover it in Ireland.
I don't know what the public think. It's hard to know, you know, because earlier on we were talking about the cost of uninsured drivers and how much it's costed the public and all, and talking about using number plate recognition if Gardaí had access to the insurance company's databases and stuff. But I don't know what the listeners out there think. Do they think it's an overreach? This is Big Brother, whatever, next let's resist it. Or are they saying, you know what, if it brings my premium down, people shouldn't be breaking the law anyway, you know, more power to them. But I don't really know what's going on out there, what the general population think.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think it's something to be interesting to hear from your listeners on that. The big thing here is that it's all about road safety. And I'm sure you've seen it yourself, that driving standards have dropped significantly in the last few years in Ireland. I think it's only anecdotal evidence, obviously, but my own experience on the roads every day is that more and more people are taking risks and they're, you know, breaking red lights, using mobile phones, using bus lanes, all this kind of thing. And I believe the main reason for that is that Gardaí enforcement has reduced over the last few years due to lack of resources. You know, it's not a criticism of local Gardaí or the Gardaí force as such, as perhaps the lack of resources there. And it's a contagion. You know, if you're stuck in traffic every day on your commute and you're seeing people every day flying up the bus lane and getting away with it, that's going to increase the number of people that do that. And likewise, going through red lights, this is a particular bugbear of mine at the moment. It feels like every junction I come to where there's a red light, I see two or three people breaking a red light. And I don't just mean the last second where it's just gone red, which of course you're not supposed to be doing. I mean, you know, 2-3 seconds later. Mm. So they're going through, the other lights are already green on the other side, or pedestrian light is already green, and yet you have other cars gone through again.
Yeah, would this replace the GoSafe cameras? Because I think that's a failed experiment, to be honest. And I think really that's highlighted on the National Go Slow Days, whereby they don't detect anyone because everyone knows where they are. They slow down going past them and then batter on thereafter. I think, as I say, I think it's a failed experiment, and the only ones that work are the shooting fish in a barrel ones. Could you see this new system replacing that kind of way of doing things?
I think so, actually. And there was mention in the initial story on this in the Irish Times, where the idea might be that this system, or whatever this becomes, does replace the GoSafe idea. And I agree with you 100%. They're such a blunt instrument. They make sense, perhaps, if you want, for safety reasons, to slow down motorists in a very specific point. But fixed speed cameras are...
Like outside a school, where you never bloody see them. You see them just as the speed limit changes out of town. Grand, okay. I know there might have been one serious collision there in the past, and I get that. But we know where they are. We know what they're designed to do. And as I say, I think the worst advertising for them is the National Slowdown Day, because 80,000 cars go past, they detect 300 speeding? Come on, it's a lot of you-know-what.
Yeah, and it's absolute nonsense. They don't work from that perspective. And I agree with you on their positioning as well. I mean, what is the point of having them visible on a motorway where there's almost no collisions, and motorways are the safest roads we have? And yet you have people flying past schools at 60 kilometres an hour, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're a five-year-old walking along next to your parents walking to school, a car flying past you on the road, you know, a metre away at that speed is significant. And, you know, it's a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, I'd love to see more enforcement there. And not to mention the fellow or the lady in the back finishing off their PhD. But anyway, how long can you see... How long do you think... You see, the other problem is though, this means cameras in an awful lot of places. This means cameras that will check our speed between, not just like the Port Tunnel, but check our speed between, say, for instance, Ballybuffet and Letterkenny. You know, it could determine that if we arrived there too quick, we must have broken the speed limit along the way. Do you know, it starts getting very, I don't know, Big Brotherish too. So I don't know which way I want it to go, to be honest with you, in the last minute, Shane.
Yeah, I think there will definitely be privacy concerns about this. Anything using more cameras, there's going to be outcry about that. It isn't yet clear whether it's going to be doing speed averaging. I think the biggest thing is that the AI is going to spot whether you're using a mobile phone, spot whether you have your seatbelts on. And that seems to be the focus at the moment of using AI. And that's interesting. It'll still be checked by a human. That's also worth pointing out. But I don't know. I'm all for something that will improve enforcement on our roads.
All right, listen, lovely to have you on the show again, Shane. Take care of yourself. Have a lovely day. Shane O'Donoghue, editor of completecar.ie. Check out their website there. 086 60 25,000. Any texts you want to get into us, we can pick them up for tomorrow. That's where we have to leave it today, though. Thanks to Niamh, who assisted Caroline Orr, who researches and produces this show every day.